tonight to this edition of Adventures into Sovereignty. We're joined tonight by my guest, Tex Masson, who is out in California this time. And I'll have to tell you that Andrew Bartizes is not going to be with us tonight. He's taking a much-needed break. So thank you, Santi, for all your help behind the scenes, and let's welcome Tex tonight. It's wonderful to have you on the show after our few little glitches there. Tex, how are you tonight?
I'm doing outstanding. It's wonderful to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yes. Well, you know, you and I have been doing these calls back and forth. I don't even remember how long we've been working together. But it's really fun to have you on tonight because one of the things that people just keep asking and asking is, okay, we have so many things that we need to learn about this adventure into sovereignty. And it's not nearly as easy as we thought it would be. We have so much to learn and we don't know where to start. So the perfect person to bring on tonight to start helping you answer some of those questions is Tex, because of all the people that I've worked with down through the years, he seems to have put a lot of time and effort into really just doing this kind of step by step. Wouldn't you say, Tex? I'd like for you just to kind of look at this as, you know, back over the years, you've been doing this about, what, 6-8 years now?
I think it's been about six.
Yeah, about 6 years, and it hasn't always, you know, once you start this game, you've got to keep it up. There's really a lot to learn, and there are things that everybody has to do to get in the mindset of what we're doing here. So absolutely. Take off for a while, and yeah, give us some idea, if you were starting in this all over again right now, how would you start? Let's just look at it from that standpoint and see if we can help some of these people who are having the most trouble right now.
Well, thank you. Well, thank you for, I think that's a perfect question and a perfect place to begin, because I've probably been doing this for 6 years, but in reality, that 6 years might be equivalent to somebody that's been doing it for 10 years, because I was kind of fortunate, and I would say fortunate because I didn't know it was turning out this way when I started out. But I was fortunate to be put in a position by circumstance and somewhat by choice to be able to do this full time every day, you know, when I wake up. So I've been doing it kind of full time for 5 years now, studying around the clock, you know, sometimes out of necessity, sometimes out of a passion. And, it, you know, it's something that I found that this is also my passion, too. So when I first got involved, though, I was probably like a lot of people. And this isn't the right way to get involved, so I'm telling you from my experience. When I first got involved, I had problems that I was trying to fix. And I know, you know, we all have problems in financial problems or problems with the court, and that's just going to be a part of life. But, you know, one thing I know now is that you can never overcompensate. I mean, you can't move forward without competency. And I know a lot of times we want to just have a quick-made solution. We want somebody just to give it to us, and we kind of want to – it's not that we want to forego the competency, but we put our but our problems are too important that we want to resolve them right now. And honestly, when I first got in, it was because I had problems that I wanted to resolve, and really I probably would have never pursued this study if I didn't think that I was going to have a solution within the first 3 months when I got involved. That's where my mindset was. I thought that, hey, I heard that you can discharge debts, and I got this mortgage problem. Let me study this accept it for value thing. And in 3 months, because it all was plausible, it sounded good when I heard somebody talking about it, all I need to know is HJR 192, write it on his paper with the red pen, and I'm going to discharge my mortgage. And I honestly believe that, so I started pursuing it, thinking that it was going to happen tomorrow. And then somewhere around 3 years in, I realized that everything I was learning was a lifelong pursuit. So one of the first things that I would really encourage people is, no matter how long it takes you, be thorough. And I know you can get overwhelmed because there's all these different elements of commerce to study. If you have a situation that you need to resolve, focus on that, but be thorough in your understanding. Don't put something on a paper that you don't understand. Research it. If you hear somebody, like when I'm on here and I'm saying things, if I cite a reference or I give you a statute or a code, it's not enough to say, yeah, I know what HAR 192 is. Have you went and actually read through it multiple times? I still read through it today and learn different things. So one thing I'll say is develop good habits from the very beginning. Take notes. If you're good online, take online notes and be thorough. You know, be thorough with every, you know, with every part, everything that you do. Be thorough and don't, I don't know how long you want me to just go off the beginning, but I've also prepared, you know, some things. Like if you're very, because this is really a lifelong thing. I know people don't want to hear this, but if you're, you know, if your ultimate goal is not to be a life student of this, then you're probably not going to be successful in it. This is not something that you're going to get a quick remedy, because once you start digging into it, you're going to see that we've been conditioned and manipulated, and we've been moving in the total wrong direction. We got to stop, collect, and then refocus, you know, point into the right direction and then start moving forward. So we got a lot of deconditioning to do also. Yeah. On that note, let me mention one more thing that's very important. I've got, you know, I've had this problem. I still have the problem and I'm overcoming it. And I, when I coach and consult people, I see a lot of people, because generally a lot of us that are pursuing these things, we're generally intelligent people. So, you know, so you hear a new concept and you would think, oh yeah, that makes sense. I understand it. But you don't understand how much conditioning, you know, sometimes we take for granted how much the conditioning and manipulation has really affected us. So we think that, you know, somebody can present a new concept to you and then you can make it a part of your whole psyche without going to revisit that concept and learn it and make it a part of yourself. Like, for, you know, I would say, for example, I'll give an example how money works. And maybe everybody doesn't on the call understand how money works, but I'll tell you that for all money, there has to be an asset backing it. And just to make it plain and simple, the asset that backs all the money, all the currency, it comes from you. So in some form or another, you are the source that's backing the money. So that means you have an entitlement. There's something that's owed to you. You may not know how to get it yet, but there's something that's owed to you. But a lot of people will hear and they learn a little bit, and then they start to say, well, you know, they're printing money out of thin air. There's no gold, you know, gold and silver doesn't back the money, so they're printing it out of thin air. And then they think that's enough because they understand that. But if you just are so quick and willing to accept that, then that prevents you from going into a further study to figure out where does the money really come from. Because I'm telling you, it doesn't come from thin air.
No.
Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
It doesn't come from thin air. And that's one of the things that we emphasize over and over on this call. And one of the things that we've really learned as we've worked with Rod Class and a lot of the material this year is through the War Powers Act of 1917, when the people were... When the resources of the people were conscripted for the war effort, and all the resources of the people were taken, and then we followed it down with what we call the source documents, so that people can begin to understand that there is literally a slavery contract that belongs to us, and that had a birth, you know, at the time of the live birth event. We can prove that there was $1.8 million through the Social Security Act of 1935 that was conscripted as your value right at that point, and $1 million per year thereafter. And we say this to people, and they look at me a lot of times and like, you don't know what you're talking about, because they just cannot imagine that somebody would set that value up for their benefit and then literally steal it out from under us. But we have found, as we've done our thorough research, that is the truth, that we are the value, and so that we have to be able to understand and accept that thinking before we can go on and then begin to understand, okay, so there are things we can do within this commerce game that we have to learn to do. So that, I think that's a very valuable point.
Right, the birth certificate, as a matter of fact, and that's always, I recently I've got some letters back. This might sound interesting. I've been sending out a lot of Freedom of Information Act requests. And if anybody doesn't know what that is, they call it FOIA, Freedom of Information Act. This is one of, especially if you're new to this is absolutely one of the strongest tools that you can use. I send out a FOIA request probably at least once a week to some place. And consequently, sometimes I'm on the phone with the IRS. I've been on the phone with the Department of Justice, the Securities Exchange Commission, the Treasury. 'Cause whenever we need some information, you send out a Freedom of Information request and send it to one of these government officers. But I brought that up because, talking about the birth certificate, I've recently sent FOIA requests to the Securities Exchange Commission, asking for financial records and CUSIP numbers and other things as relates to the birth certificate. And I sent it to a couple of different federal agencies. And I kind of noticed that, and I don't know how familiar the listening audience is, but there's kind of a delineation between public and private. Every public officer, every officer has a duty and an obligation to the public, as well as he has a duty and an obligation to the private. He's protecting both sides. So he's protecting trade secrets on the private, and he's protecting the ignorance that's supposed to take place in the public, if you will. But so I asked him about the birth records, and of course they, I don't want to get too complex. So I will say this about the birth certificate. What Rebecca brought up in my research is absolutely true. I don't know if you guys have heard the term, what is it called, actuarial tables, where,
Where?
basically, do you know what that is? The actuarial
Yes.
tables?
Sure.
Okay, so now here's and I welcome anyone else to chime in, but from my understanding, when I sent these requests off to these different agencies, they all came back and told me, this is just a birth certificate. There is no money assigned with it. And that really surprised, I mean, it surprised me for a couple of different reasons. One, because I had to sit back and reevaluate and scratch my head, because I was like, wait a minute, if there was no value assigned to this, they never would have called it a certificate in the first place.
Yep.
Because a certificate is a financial instrument, and that might be new to a lot of people, but a certificate is a financial instrument. It would have just been called a birth record if there was no money tied to it. So I started to really think about it, but I was like, on the other hand, these are public officers. So I said, either these people are, they might be ignorant, which is a possibility, because the way that things are set up in the military, and we are under martial law, we're under military rule, and the way that things are set up in the military, and I was in the Marine Corps for 8 years, is you only get the piece that's necessary for you to know in order to do your job. So, I got to thinking about it, and I said, well, either these people that I'm dealing with are ignorant, or they're trying to protect trade secrets. But and it's a little bit off the subject, but I would say my understanding of the birth certificate is the certificates that we use, I don't think they were telling me a story when they said we don't have any financial records and there's no value assigned to this certificate, because I enclosed a certificate with my request. Because I believe that those actual birth certificates, the ones that we hold, they only have a value when you tender them in commerce. So
Good point.
now
Good point.
that's not to say that certificate, our certificates have been tendered in commerce, and there's values associated with business that's already been conducted. But when you take that birth certificate to someone and you say, I need to know the CUSIP number and the value assigned to it, I believe that they'll look at you and say, there's no value. It's like a check. When you have a checkbook, right? Until you use one of those checks, it's just a blank check. It's still a security. It's printed on security paper, but it has no value until
Right.
it's actually used in commerce. That's something that I recently, I kind of thought about it before, but it's something I recently really begin to understand. I really begin to understand it. But so, if you will, I'll kind of just start. I'll kind of go in and talk about the commercial setup. And I'm using that very loosely, because when I say the commercial setup, I want to present it in such a way so you can see how this whole, the government and everything is viewing you, and then you'll see what your disposition is. You'll see where the problem is, and then we'll kind of discuss how you should be operating, ideally, if you were never conditioned and manipulated to be a slave. Because
okay. That sounds like a good plan. Okay, let's go for it.
Okay, so we'll start because we mentioned the birth certificate. So of course it all goes back to the bankruptcies. We know there was a couple of different bankruptcies that took place in this country, and in one of the earlier bankruptcies, they took all the assets, you know, the property and the belongings. They took the assets and pledged them to back the debt. And then there's always got to be an asset backing the debt. So in one of the earlier bankruptcies, and I'm not good with dates and everything, you guys can look that up, but I'm just paraphrasing. At one point, the assets were pledged to back the debt so that commerce can continue internationally. And then after that, we went into another bankruptcy somewhere further down the line. And then at that point, the money, and when I say money, I'm talking about the gold and the silver that used to be the asset backing the notes, that was then pledged and then confiscated. And that's when you get around the HJR 192, where it became unlawful to use gold and silver for monetary purposes. And they actually went and confiscated the gold and silver. And then going further down the line into the next bankruptcy, there's no more money or gold or silver to back the currency, the paper currency, and there's no more, and all the land and assets have been pledged. So now the only thing that's left is to pledge the citizens themselves.
Capital, have you seen any of the executive orders which absolutely refer to the people as the human capital? We have those exhibits so that people who question whether or not we are the asset backing it, we can prove that it is the human capital of the people that goes into trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars that the president simply takes any time he wants to and creates the monetary value through that.
Right. And the good thing to understand, though, is, you know, you can never, although you may or may not want to get rid of say you take the assets of the people, or you pledge the people's faith against the fiat currency. The good thing, there's an accounting, and the law is immutable and invariable. So you may say, oh, they're operating in fraud and this, that, and the other, but what I'm saying is everything that has been pledged is due to come back to you. So there is always a form of redemption or recoupment, something that you're entitled to. Everything must come back to the source. So, but back on to the point. So the birth record or the birth certificate is, you know, and here's another point I'll make. A lot of people don't understand that the birth certificate is a form of money, or that these certificates are a form of money, because one thing you will learn is that from the Federal Reserve or from the United States perspective, there's different types of money. There's transaction money, which we're all familiar with. That's the Federal Reserve notes, checks, money orders, the type of money we use on a daily basis. But then there's another form of money that deals with securities, and most of us don't deal with securities, so that's why when we're looking at certificates, we don't perceive the real value, you know, we don't perceive the real value of them. But hold on, I'm going through my little notes here. Let me see, where can I go from here, from with the birth certificate? So the name of the game is money, of course. And the ideal since there has to be an asset backing the money, the goal is, actually, I want to read this to you because I actually have it. I've written it out for you guys, and it'll be better if I read it so I don't miss anything here. Sure. Sorry, let's see. Okay, I'm just going to read here. The thing that makes things difficult to understand is the fact that we never understood the mechanics behind the money. And the banks and the people that deal with securities benefit based on our ignorance. So as I said before, there's always an asset backing the commercial paper. So we have to have a clear understanding of the commercial asset backing every liability or every obligation to pay. Let's see. We just see this happens in the hell. Okay, so I'm going to give an example. This is one that we can all. I'm going to give this example of kind of like the creation of money, And I'm going to give the example of a promissory note because most people own a house and everything like that. So we know that at the closing, when you go down to a closing table, notice when you're at the closing table, none of the transactions could facilitate until you got to signing paperwork. So this is what happens at closing. Remember going to the closing when nothing couldn't facilitate until you started signing papers. So many things we didn't understand, but it seemed a lot of transactions took place at the closing table. But the only thing what happened when we left was we were left with the liability. So what we have to know is when you sign a note, when you signed a promissory note, you used your credit, and the promissory note was actually a security. So I guess what I'm trying to show you is where money comes from. And this happens in almost any money transaction, but this is an easy one to see with the promissory note. Your signature on a Federal Reserve instrument binds you to the liability, but your signature on a foreign instrument makes you the issuer or the maker or binds the recipient to the liability. Stop me if I'm going over people's head, but when you're signing a promissory note, when you're signing anything for that matter, you're involved in the creation of money.
Anything exactly. Yes, exactly at that point. And we've been able to go back through the congressional records and everything and prove that it is your signature that actually creates the credit. But the problem is that the people who are the bankers who have the fiduciary duty to discharge the debt and give this the value back to the people have started basically embezzling those funds instead of letting us utilize that resource that was there for us to use. And I think this is the thing that people have the hardest time wrapping their minds around. Because the way it was really designed to work was that your signature on that promissory note gave the Federal Reserve, the bankers through the Federal Reserve window, the access to those funds, and according to the way the laws are written, and especially with this war crimes, I mean with the Trading with the Enemies Act, if you go back and understand that, then the alien property custodian is supposed to be responsible for the people's debts since they confiscated all of the property for the corporation for the war effort. So that's absolutely where we get into a lot of the problem here. This was the way it was supposed to set up, but that's not the way it's working. So what you're doing with your process now is going in there and trying to hold those agents accountable to that fiduciary duty. And basically what I understand is that instead of trying to go through the public side because they're not doing that, State Secrets Act and all of that, then your processes are helping access the private side of all of this. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, but what people have to understand is that they maintain a presence in the public side of commerce and on the private side of the commerce, but most of us are asleep on the private side and we're unaware of that. I'm glad you brought that up because that helps me out. So going back to the promissory note, on the private side, it's your signature that creates money. When you read Modern Money Mechanics, and that's a book by the Federal Reserve, and it's an excellent read, and anybody learning this stuff should read it, because they talk about the creation of money. They explain to you how it's done. But here's one thing that they say, and I'm going to give you a clue because you probably wouldn't pick it up if you're reading it for the first time. They tell you clearly that the money creation process starts in the bank. But what they're not telling you is that that entity that you're operating from, that straw man, as we like to call it, that is a bank. And that is the bank that they're telling you where the money creation process starts. That is the bank. So now on the private side of commerce, so let's put it like this. If everybody is a bank, because you are, and remember, The bank is the source of the money. So this all comes together kind of like I was telling you. There always has to be an asset backing the liability. That's why you always have to sign money into existence. Back in the day where there's gold and silver, you had to pledge some type of asset. But now you just have to sign money into existence because of how the commercial system is set up at this point, because of all the pledging of the assets and, as Rebecca mentioned, the War Powers Act. So when you sign that promissory note at a closing, you actually did a transaction on a private side. Of course, you didn't know it, and they didn't break that down to you. And that's because your ignorance in that particular transaction, which is how they facilitate all transactions, is why you agree to receive all the liability, and everybody else in the closing room makes money except for you. Now, if you went to that closing table and you were required to pull out of your bag $100,000 worth of gold, then you would kind of understand things a little bit differently. You'll understand that you didn't really receive a loan, but that you gave value in the whole transaction. You'll understand that. But what I was going to say is, when you issue a promissory note, when your signature goes on the instrument, that allows for the Federal Reserve, when the Federal Reserve makes a deposit on that item, they have to put reserves on their books, but they also fractionalize off of it. So basically, to say, if you gave $100,000 note in your foreign currency, because that's actually what it is when you sign a promissory note, that's foreign currency. By the time it gets deposited into that Federal Reserve Bank and they do their conversion on it, or they're fractionalizing, when it converts into Federal Reserve money, let's call it that just to make it simple, it's the same amount that you deposited times 10. So what I'm trying to explain to you is that was the money creation process. Money was created there. Now, just looking at the scenario, we're not going to go all the way through it, but just looking at the scenario, what happens to the asset that you've given them? What happens to the note? Well, that's, you know, they call it a demand deposit account. But basically what I'm trying to tell you is the note is still sitting there and it's waiting to be claimed by you. And until you claim it, until you figure out how to go get the principal back on the money that you created, other people are going to use it. And that same basic scenario is the way that all money is created. So when you look at the whole entire debt of the United States, however many trillion dollars it is, you pretty much can take it, you know, between all the citizens and nationals and divide it up, and that's your share of assets. That's your share of the money. That's the asset side of the equation that's owed to you. So one of the things, in order to be able to start claiming, now here's another important point I have to mention. There's a difference between a United States citizen and a national. And this is very important, because
yes, and so that's really one of the most important points that people constantly ask. How do we establish status and standing so that we do not come under this as a slave of the corporations? You know, how do we establish status and standing? And I know that that's one of the things that you've really worked diligently on these last 6 years, is to find ways to establish that status and standing so that you are outside of the corporate influence. So this is what you're talking about when you're talking about the difference between the citizenship classification. So this would be a good thing to explain so that people really do understand that.
Okay, what from my study, and remember, I'm just a student at this. I've done a lot, you know, I've probably done a lot more than most people. But from my study, the first thing I would have to say is, in order to do any of these things commercially, in order to take control of your vessels and take control of your affairs, the first thing you have to do is you have to understand the delineation between the citizen and the national. First off, the citizen is a security, basically. The citizen is essentially the same property indicated with the birth certificate. See, you know, the way I look at this birth certificate, it's a certificate, so it represents title to an asset. Now, the question is, what is that asset? Many of us has been manipulated and conditioned to act as the citizen or the surety. So we've been conditioned to identify with the birth certificate, and identity means to make the same as. So we've been taught from the very beginning to be the citizen, to be the surety, to be the property. And we know that property
to answer to the name,
right.
Answer to the name, because Deborah was explaining on the call a couple of weeks ago, the idiom sonum, you know, it sounds alike, and therefore right. You don't know the difference, so you agree to be that citizen that is basically a dead fiction.
Right, and that's what makes you the surety. That's what makes you the slave to whatever transaction they're doing. That's what makes you have to bear the liability. Now, as a national, on the other hand, with a similar sounding name, but it's not the same, because again, a name is a trade name. But a national, on the other hand, is not property. A national actually has rights. See, citizens don't have rights. You know, and I know that's hard for people to comprehend and understand, but no, citizens don't have rights. Citizens are property. As a matter of fact, I have a friend of mine, and he's into trading. He's pretty knowledgeable with trading securities and things like that, and he's studying for, I believe, a Series 3 or Series 7 license. And something that he actually told me that citizens, you know, United States citizens cannot be on the trading floor at Wall Street. And I was like, that's interesting. But he said only nationals and foreigners. And of course, you know, when he came across that information, it was in his studies, but it made perfect sense to me, because more than likely citizens are getting traded across that floor. So you can't be in two places at the same time. You know, you can't be on the floor getting traded. Your name comes across the screen and you're like, no, that's me. You know, you're actually being traded. But,
this is so hard for a lot of people to really wrap their minds around. Because it has been done with such deliberate deception to bring us into this mind game so that we aren't able to understand it. So it is, you know, and for so many people, a lot of people on the call have become very aware that there is a slavery contract and have become very aware. But really getting down to understand it and then what they can do about it is always the real, real hard thing for people to really just wrap their minds around. And sometimes the more we study, the worse it gets. There should be a simpler way, and there's got to be. But it's you know, a lot of times you want to just walk away from it and figure out the ways that you can do that, but it just doesn't always work that easily, does it?
It doesn't, and, you know, the diligence will pay off in the long run, is what I can tell people. You know, the diligence will pay off in the long run. I mean, if you look at all the situations that you have in your life now, and most of them are commercial in one form or another, if you had the ability to discharge any obligation whatsoever, It'll be worth all the trials and the study and the tribulation that you have to go through to get there. It absolutely be worth it. You know, it actually absolutely be worth it. I'm trying to draw some more distinctions about, you know, how important this, because I really can't express how important it is to understand what a citizen is. And to understand the difference between a citizen and a national, because here's something that I'm learning. You know, we talk about correcting status. There's not just one place that you will correct your status. When you look at the Department of State, for example, which deals with travel in and out of the country, and you start going through the Immigration and Nationality Act, you will see clear, and if you get on the phone with them, I've been on the telephone with them, they will tell you clearly, and this might be new to some of you guys, but they will tell you. They're not going to come out their mouth until you ask the right question, but there is a difference between a national and a citizen. So there is a way to, there's a way that you have to correct your status with the IRS. That's one whole separate thing in itself. There's not one place where you're going to correct your status and you're going to be gold across the board. You have to correct your status with the IRS. You have to correct your status on your county level, because everybody is viewing you as a slave. You have to correct your status with the Department of State. They have a certain way, you know, and it depends. Like, everywhere where you have contracts, there's a way to correct your status. Now, typically, the citizen uses the Social Security number. I'm not going to say that, I couldn't definitively say that just because you have a Social Security number, it means you're a citizen. But in most cases, that is the case. So a lot of people that are more advanced in their studies, when they start to learn these things, a citizen, basically everything, every commercial entity is a trust anyway. But a citizen is a trust where everything is completely controlled. So a lot of people, what they do is, one of the first things that they do is they set up a foreign trust. And have you guys talked about that any bit, the foreign situs trust?
We haven't talked about it on this show. We haven't really gone into any depth and detail on any of the trust information yet. We've had a couple of people who have mentioned it, but they haven't gotten into the distinctions or anything like that. So,
okay, well, let me talk about the foreign situs trust a little bit. And I encourage you guys, because I'm going to be honest with you, it's hard for me to kind of just sit and talk, because, like, I can talk, but I could be talking over people. But what I'm real good at is, when somebody has a specific question that they don't understand, I can break it down and really relate it into a way that you can understand it. But I think maybe we can go talk about, and now for everybody listening, I use the term foreign situs trust. What I'm speaking about is not like your standard trust, like you might set up a business trust or a family trust. I'm talking about something very specific to the individual, if you will. Something that's going along with correcting your status as opposed to a citizen. Now, everybody doesn't find it beneficial to do this, but I think most people should, because remember, they're treating you like a slave through that trade name, because you never understood what it was, and you thought that that was you. Now, because you still have to operate in commerce, as a U.S. citizen, as an individual, which the IRS will look at you as, or a U.S. person, that's what the IRS looks at you as, you're within the jurisdiction, or you're under their control. There is nothing that stops you from setting up your own entity. See, because remember, you didn't set up the Social Security number in that whole setup. That was set up for you. But you can set up, say if your name is John Alex Doe and you have a Social Security number, you can set up a John Alex Doe Trust. And I've done that for myself. So let me take myself as an example. Once I realized all this stuff was going on, my straw name is Sylvester Moore. So I set up a Sylvester Moore Foreign Situs Trust. And so I'm not going to go too much into the foreign part, but let me tell you the reason why the trust is foreign, the reason why it was set up as foreign. Because right now, the trust that you're operating through by default is a domestic trust, and you're not in control of it. Doesn't have to be that way, but you're doing it. You volunteered to be a slave, and I know you don't understand that, but you did. You volunteered to be a slave. So when I say that, that's because you picked up these things, you started using them, and you never asked any questions. So that, that's a form of, volunteering. But when I became aware of this, I set up a foreign situs trust, because I said, I have to do commerce. I got to continue to do commerce, but I need to have, but I need to have control. So every commercial status has to have a number associated with it, because that's how we do business here. So your slave trust typically rolls with your Social Security number. But once you start correcting your status, then you start doing your affairs in a different trust. Because when you're operating through a foreign trust, the governing agents of the United States don't have the same type of control. They don't have the same type of commercial rights to tell you how to move, when to move, and to force you to be a liability or a subject. So that's kind of the purpose for setting up, you know, the four insiders trust, if you will. Actually, and I know I'm brushing on topics that many people, it might be kind of over some people's head, but
I tell you what, let's break in and just tell them that one of the things that you do as through your thctrust.org is that you have the templates and the ability to help people when they really want to get into some of this understanding, when they want to get into setting up these foreign situs trusts, when they want to learn administrative procedures. You've done one of the better jobs that I've seen of being able to have this information very accessible to the people who are on your site, who are willing to put the time and the effort into setting up these various things. I know that you do both, you teach very well the administrative remedies. You also teach how to do the secured party status. You know, you have those set up to help.
Right.
So that, give that information so that people will know how to get to your information.
Okay, well, the website is thctrust.org. That's T as in Tango, H as in Hotel, C as in Charlie. It actually stands for The Heavenly Crown. So it's thctrust.org, not com, not .com, not .net, thctrust.org. And there's a lot of resources there. There's resources that will show you how to apply for the right tax ID number when you're going to start operating under a foreign situs trust. There's a lot of information there, but what I want to encourage people to do is if you visit the site, before you go in and start trying to set stuff up, there's a lot of foundational information. I even have a place on there that says getting started. You can go through and get breakdowns of how the money creation process works, which is actually important. You can learn the differences between the citizen and the national. So a lot of that stuff is there. So I encourage you to get a thorough understanding. Don't rush anything. You know, get a good understanding, but once you get that understanding and you're ready to move forward, one thing that I've done is I have a lot of templates to help people move forward because I've done a lot of things myself. I've done a lot of things as relates to correcting your status. And you're going to find it's a lifelong thing. You know, I personally know people who've excelled far past me in these type of studies, and every single day they're still studying and correcting their status. So this thing, it's a lifelong study. You know, it's a lifelong study.
Well, it's really very difficult to wrap our minds around the fact that a governing system would set so many obstacles in place for the average person and then not bother to teach them any of it. So part of our responsibility as we begin to go into a sovereign mindset is that we do have to, you know, we have to take responsibility for this ourselves. I think that's the most important thing that I've learned as I've worked helping my brother. And, you know, we all get into this for various reasons and have so much learning that we do. But now, also, we have so many people who are dealing with IRS issues or, you know, who just want to learn through dealing with a traffic ticket or a bench warrant or just anything like that. What would you say would be the most important thing if you're sending them to study? Where are they going to start when they're in trouble?
Well, that's a good question. Here's my personal take. When you're in trouble, first you got to make a judgment call, because one thing we didn't talk about, which I should have brought up before we even started talking about a foreign situs trust, is an estate. Because everybody has an estate, whether you set one up or not. There's an estate set up for you at birth. And we all kind of know what an estate is, but I basically say that's everything that's related or associated with your trade name. That's part of your estate. So on the estate, what we're all supposed to be that we're not, we're all supposed to be executors or executrix. You know, but bottom line is executor, just like if you worked in corporate America, executive officer is the decision maker and the shot caller. You know, they're not passive, and that's what we have to do. We have to become decision makers. We don't have all the information yet, but that shouldn't stop us from making the best decisions that we can based on the information that we have or based on our circles and our resources. So to bring that relevant to Rebecca's question, say you have a traffic issue and you've been learning some of this stuff, right? You've been learning maybe discharging debt, or maybe you've been learning that you are traveling and not driving. I always say, if it's something like a traffic ticket, go get your feet wet.
Yep.
if it's not a federal indictment and you're looking at going to jail for 20 years or something like that, go get your feet wet. Use it as you can practice. You can start learning administrative procedure, because you may want to attempt to discharge it and using an administrative procedure to enforce it. Or you may want to, you know, if you feel comfortable, you may want to go into the court and you may want to, you know, you may want to deal with it right there on the spot, saying, how can I pay for it? You know, so, but the point I want to make is, you know, judgment call, you know, if it's something simple, use it as a tool to get your, you know, to get your feet wet.
Or learn how to send it back, you know, so that you do not become liable for it by refusing the contract within the 3 days. You know, there are just so many things like that you can learn, but you do have to take responsibility for it yourself. And it is just, there is a learning curve that is involved. And yes, the best way to do it is to, you know, use caution, but to utilize those things that are in front of you in order to be responsible. And it has become much more, there are so many more people involved in home foreclosures. And right. I don't know about your area, but in my little town and these rural towns in Georgia, we have so many traffic cops now that there's somebody stopped on every corner because the municipalities are just taking advantage of the citizens. I mean, there's really a lot of highway robbery going on. And so there's you know, we have to become responsible, because when we're not, we allow this to happen to us. So right. that's a big part of what this is about.
Right. And what the way that I'm studying to deal with things, so I'm gonna tell you, and this will be, I think, if you want a direction to look at, to study, this is how anything that's debt related, like say, for example, speeding tickets or whatever, my approach is, I believe if it's debt related, discharge it, because you can challenge it. You can challenge it and ask for, you know, you can either challenge it and force them to establish their position, or you can go for discharging it. Now, I know a lot of people, you're not going to just be able to discharge a traffic ticket by just putting A for V on the back of it. And some of you will be able to. You know, there's a lot of different variables. There's more than one way to discharge a debt. But I'm going to, I'm going to tell you, some people are going to beat me up for this. You know, I'm telling you, because I sent this out to my mailing list, and I have a lot of people that actually coach me, and they're going to really beat me up for what I'm about to tell you guys. But I'm going to tell you, because the information needs to get out, and this is where you should start your study. I'm going to quote a couple of statutes that you guys got to start looking at if you're really serious about discharging debt. And I'm not going to go too far. I'm just going to say enough. And you guys know some of them already. 12 USC 95A2. You know, I'm sure you guys have talked about that, because that's the hot topic right now.
Yeah.
It talks about, you know, reversionary interest and things like that. But read that, because here's part of the I'm going to just put a little bit of the pieces of puzzle together for you. Remember, I was telling you earlier, there's a citizen and then there's a national, right? By default, many of us have both entities going on. We, you know, we can operate, the citizen operates in the public, if you will, whereas the national operates on the private side, if you will. Now, when you talk about discharging a debt, for example, the old A for V that everybody says, and a lot of people email me and say, hey, should I do my A for V like this? And the first thing I say is, there's no such thing as an A for V. And then they really get confused. But really, you know, so if you want to know what an A4V is, it's actually a bill of exchange. So there's something called the Bill of Exchange Act. Look that up. And what it is we live in a debt-based system. So you pay for a bill by tendering another bill. But to get back on the subject, because I'm dropping a couple of clues here for a lot of people that's studying, the only one who can discharge debt, the citizen can't do it. The national can. So I'm not saying that before you can discharge a debt, your status has to be right. But ideally, that's what you know, we're all working to correct our status. But what I'm saying is, you're a national whether you've corrected your status or not. You know what I'm saying? So it's almost like, you know, you can deal with the problem in real time. If your status and all that stuff isn't already corrected, you can still fix the problem in real time. But the reason why I was bringing up this difference between the citizen and the national is because that 12 USC 95A2, I encourage if you're listening to this, go write that down and read what it says. Really read closely, meditate on it, read what it says. Because first off, it's telling you the person that is able to use that as a remedy, you got to be a foreigner. So a national technically is a foreigner to the public United States democracy as we know it. Because we know there's a democracy and then there's a republic, right? Because President Obama and everybody's on TV talking about the democracy and the democracy. But meanwhile, we were told when we were coming up in school that the country was a republic and your nationals are out there in the republic and your citizens are under the democracy. So when you're trying to effect a remedy that deals with discharging debt that may come from, let's say, Public Law 7310, you know, because when you read Public Law 7310, it says because they took your right to pay in lawful money, which is gold and silver, the government has an obligation to discharge those domestic debts dollar for dollar, right? So that's what
dollar
the public
dollar.
Law says.
Exactly.
So,
yep.
But when we're doing banking, right? So if that's the United States obligation to us, when we do our banking, we don't go dealing with the United States directly. How many people bank with the United States or bank directly with the Treasury? Not many of us. So although that's their Treasury obligation, it might not be the Treasury who's gonna do the transaction for you. You might have to go to their agent, right? Does anybody know who the agents for the Treasury is? That's the whole Federal Reserve System. So when you read 12 USC 95A2, that deals with the Federal Reserve System, and it tells them what they're supposed to do when the person with the proper status makes a claim. So I'm not going to tell you what it says, but read that 12 USC 95A2 because I brought that up because if you're studying discharging debts with A4V, you need to be studying bills of exchange. You got to start learning how to write an instrument. And if you read the Bill of Exchange Act, it's going to break that down to you. So and this is real studying because I can tell you how to fill out a bill of exchange or how to write an A4V, but I'm directing you to the information that you should read so you can learn how to fill out a bill of exchange. A good way to study is look at some of these bills of exchange online, right? And then pull out the Bill of Exchange Act and read it and then look at what you see online. And you're going to say, oh, this one looks good. That one doesn't look good because it doesn't have this, that, and the other. And then another thing is if you're tendering an instrument to a court or to whatever you are, there's got to be something like, for example, if I gave you an instrument to pay for something, you're going to look at it and be like, oh, what am I supposed to do with this? So there's got to be some instructions on there that tell you where the funds are going to come from or how you're going to get the money or whatever. So, again, I encourage you, go study these things, 12 USC 95A2.
And I want to bring out one other thing here because, you know, having known a lot of the things that you've done down through the years and the things that I have done, then what we end up learning how to do is once we tender these instruments, then we also have to learn how to hold these rogue agents accountable because a lot of times, and especially it seems to me, you know, over the last few years, it has gotten much more prevalent that it is not as easy to hold these people accountable to handling the paperwork and doing the things. It's like the State Justice Institute is telling the judges and people how to get around, especially the pro se people, who are coming in to do these things. So at the same time, if you're going to do this work, then you have to be willing to follow the procedures through. And that's where it takes the understanding and the willingness to stay the course. I think that's the most important thing that we have learned down through the years, that you have to know who you are and be willing to stand in that place. And every time it comes up, you know, they're going to do everything that they can to keep you from prevailing. And you just simply have to keep moving and prevailing. That's just the way it is.
And that's why I was saying before, don't rush. Don't rush in your study, in your learning. If anybody is out there listening, and I'm gonna talk about the discharge debt, because I know that's what everybody's got, some kind of debt or something they're trying to deal with. And I was gonna go back to the another approach that you have to look at when you're dealing with these mortgages too. But don't rush in your studies. You know, absolutely be thorough, because a lot of times, you know, I'm under the belief that a lot of times when you get resistance, and this is something that we have to check ourselves too, because sometimes, you know, this is something I learned. Like, I will walk in, like, say for example, I'm trying to file something, and the public officer doesn't want to file it, and I know that the law says that if I give them something, they have to file it. Well, sometimes I've learned that sometimes you're doing something wrong, especially if you're learning this stuff from the very beginning. Never think that you're always doing it right. Sometimes sit back and really listen to what they're telling you when you're being denied something that you're trying to do, because they're probably trying to give you a clue that you're doing something wrong. Now, one thing I found is, because I've been doing this for a while, and now every time I take an action, whether I'm trying to discharge something or I'm trying to file something, I make sure I do my due diligence. And I found that when you do something right, when you really put your research in it, and you know that you're not fouling something, you're not trying to do something because you understand 50% of it, but the rest of everything on your paper, you don't understand it. When you have a thorough understanding of what you do, what you're doing, and you one thing, you feel confident about it, but usually when you do it right, there's not going to be any room for them to reject or deny what you're doing. So I say always, always do your due diligence, because once you get into these acts and you actually start studying the laws and you actually start studying the instruments, you're going to start seeing, you know, why what you've been doing before hasn't been working. And never push, so like for example, the example I was giving you guys earlier when I wrote the Securities Exchange Commission Act, the first thing the guy came back and said, there is no financial value associated with the certificate. Then I wrote him back and said, are you sure? And then we talked about mortgage-backed securities. I was on a telephone with this guy at one point, and we were talking about, you know, how the county takes certificates of title for vehicles, your warranty deeds, and how all of these certificates and deeds have an asset value registered on the county's books, and that there's a commercial value. So we went through all this stuff, and after I broke down the certificate and everything I could to prove that this instrument has a commercial value, this guy just basically said, nope, you're wrong, it doesn't. You know what I'm saying? And so I had to sit back. I couldn't sit there and keep arguing with him. I said, well, you know what? Well, thank you for your time, but I just want you to know I'm relying on the information that you've given me, because you work for the government, so I'm relying on the integrity of the information that you give me, and I have to assume that you're telling me the truth, although it goes contradictory against everything that I've studied. And I just had to leave it at that, because you know what? I got a record, and at the end of the day, if he's telling me a lie, it's going to come back and bite him. You understand what I'm saying? But the point I was trying to make is if somebody's resisting you, sit back and go reevaluate your position, and do your research to make sure that you're doing things right. And the other thing is, learn, and I wish I could teach this to you, but right now I'm just going to make you aware of it. Learn the communication traps, because we've been, the way we've been conditioned from children all the way up to high school, we've been conditioned to lose in conversation. We've been conditioned to always take positions, and taking a position is the worst thing you can do. You know, so for example, we learned that, you know, you can discharge a debt, and now we're trying to take a position and force somebody to take something. You know, what you have to learn is when you're approaching a remedy or you're trying to get to a solution, the way you get there is by asking questions, not saying you have to do this. You say, well, aren't you required to do this pursuant to what such and such and such and such says, right?
Yes.
You have to learn. And this is how you keep yourself out of trouble, especially in court. Because if you're never taking a position, you're never going to be found in contempt. You know, so you always, unfortunately, this is, you know, I can't explain, you know, the nature of conversation and how you have to understand it. But you can never take positions. You always have to ask questions. You always have to, you know, you always have to be looking for the remedy, and you always have to give a remedy at the same time. Wow, it's unfortunate. I wish I could really express. Unfortunately, this is not the type of call, I guess, where people have specific questions, and you know, but
Yeah, well, we can do that on another call. We just really weren't too set up for it tonight, and then of course having little gremlins as we got started. But a lot of times Don is set up to take the questions, and that would be an interesting thing to do, because there really is, you know, I know people have so many questions with the status and standing and how you really can operate in a way that begins to make sense for you as you begin to understand the slavery contracts and the fact that these contracts really have been foreclosed. That's been one of the most important things that we've been working with down through the last couple of years now, is just really getting to the place where we say, okay, we're no longer willing to stand under those slavery contracts, and to find ways that we are going to absolutely take back our understanding and our sovereignty, and just be willing to stand in that position. But at the same time, when we have a system that is using force and basically treating the citizens as criminals, then it makes it very, very difficult for people to have an understanding. So this has been just, you know, a really, really broad brushstroke as we begin to cover some of these things tonight. And right. Yeah, and I would just like to encourage people, if you have specific questions, feel free to email me at rebecca@humanitad.org. And then be sure to visit Texas site, thctrust.org. And, you know, start doing some of the information, because to me, one of the most important things that we have been doing through the programs that we've had going under New Earth Nation and Adventures into Sovereignty this year, we have been basically exposing the current system of law. We've been getting in there and we've been saying, okay, if you go to court, here's what you're really operating under. You know, we're basically being dealt with under war crimes tribunals, and that just really puts us into a very strange position as we begin to learn the basics of all of this and how we're going to do something about it. So the first step is really, really, really start asking questions. It's just a really important thing that we want to start asking those questions, so that we can begin to open our eyes and our minds to a different way of understanding how the world works, so that we can operate in it in a much more wise way. So we're just about to reach the end of our limit for this first call. I'd like to give you a chance to kind of wrap up and just give the people a sense of where you stand as far as what you like to do. I know one of the things that you have made is a big part of your mission is to help those people who are incarcerated, you know, help them find ways to get that taken care of so that, that there are so many people who have been so unfairly incarcerated. You might want to just mention that a few minutes before we close the call, too. Feel right. free to give a sense of how you have, how your mission works.
Okay, well, ultimately, that's what THC Trust, that's one of the main purposes, that's what our focus is. But right now, we're kind of still in the research phase because, and the, even the research that I do in regard to discharging debt, it's all... And the end result is focused on helping people that's wrongfully incarcerated. Because one thing that I understand and one thing that I've set out to do many years ago and I'm on the path is I pretty much said my goal is to master commerce completely. And I know, you know, my goal is to be able to discharge any debt, any obligation. And that includes the prison system because, you know, people are being held because there's outstanding bonds. So it's all a matter of just discharging debt. So really, the biggest thing that we're doing in that regard, because there's habeas corpuses and there's all these different methods, and I'm not taking anything away from that, but I firmly believe that once we can master commerce and discharge any obligation, then we can free people, you know, because it's because these are people are being held not for real constitutional crimes. They're being held, not everyone, but most people are being held for commercial purposes, you know, to satisfy commercial contracts so other people can get paid off them. And I know, you know, I kind of wanted to throw this out there too because we didn't talk about it, but I also wanted to talk about the mortgage situation just briefly. Just, you know, my ear being to the wire and helping a lot of people and watching what's going on, you know, I want to encourage people, if you're dealing with mortgage stuff or you see it coming on the horizon, start learning about the Fair Debt Collections Practices Act, because the people that I know that are having success in court that's dealing with mortgage situations are usually having success by bringing charges against the perpetuators, the fraudsters, by using either the RICO Act or they're using the Fair Debt Collections Practices Act. And, you know, another note, I know we mentioned administrative procedure. I listened to the last call that Deborah was on here, and she was talking about the importance of using these notaries. And I really, you know, if you guys don't know what administrative procedure is, I really want to encourage you, if you visit thctrust.org, there's videos on there where there's a gentleman named Brandon from Creditors and Commerce, and he breaks down administrative procedure. And this is something that if you're new to this, if you're not even new to it, because many people that has been doing this for a while, they don't understand how to create records, and this is where all your power is, the ability to create records. So learning how to use the notary and learning how to do an administrative presentment is one of the most powerful things you can do, because you can really, like if you're dealing with the mortgage and you're not down to the wire, you can study the FDCPA, because you can default these lenders and these attorneys through various violations of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, because they can't even foreclose or collect against you without violating that act. And then you can use that as a, and if you know how to do an administrative procedure or you know how to use these notaries, you can bring proof of these violations of the RICO Act or the Fair Debt Collections Practices Act. You can bring your proof in court as evidence. And then you should start to see some successes there.
Yeah, this has been one of the most important techniques that we have utilized down through the years. And I think that this is a very, you know, you can stay out of court a lot of times by doing these kinds of things as you are establishing your records. So I think that's a very valid thing to be able to bring out.
You have to be able to do that.
Yeah. So, and all of that is on your website, and you do just a really good job of helping people understand that. So, you know, if that's something that interests you, that would be a good way to start doing some of the study here, because like we say, you know, it's very important that you do totally understand the current system of law, because, you know, unless you understand it and unless you really begin to understand the pure corruption that's behind a lot of it. I mean, as the slavery contract itself, for Pete's sakes, who would do this to people? You know, and so it's something that we've really just got to wake up and pay more attention to, so that yes. we can find ways to stand as sovereign beings, because, you know, I'm not willing to be a slave to anybody. And right. so that's a big part of our responsibility, is just learning how to stand in our own power. So that's just a real big part of it.
Absolutely. I had a list here of some resources that I was going to encourage people to go look up, because I know people okay. say, oh, what am I supposed to study? So I'm just going to name a couple things to study. One, there's a document, and you can Google it, and if you can't find it on Google, you can find it under the reading list at thctrust.org. It's called Universal Legal Technology Language. And the documents that I'm giving you are really going to help you until you get real competent on the private side, when we talk about discharging debts and all these higher level remedies. These are the things that's going to help you in the beginning to get some of your affairs under control. The reason I mention this document, Universal Legal Technology Language, because it's going to show you some things about the subversive use of language, and it's going to show you a little bit of the word manipulation that's taking place. And actually, when I read this document myself, it's greatly excelled and made my writing better. So if you're going to be dealing with anything in court, or even debt collectors and things like that, this document should just help you with your general writing. Something else to study, as I mentioned before, the administrative procedure, you know, study that. And that, again, when you study administrative procedure, if you watch the videos that I have on the site on thctrust.org, know that's telling you the whole administrative process. But what you don't have to do a full-blown administrative process. The key is, when you learn it, learn how to use the notary. That's the key. Focus on how to use the notary, because anytime I'm sending out communications, I'm doing an administrative process. And all we're really saying about administrative process is everything that you send should be done in such a way that it's establishing a record. Here's something else I want to mention. Everybody has to learn how to write an affidavit. You must learn how to write an affidavit. An easy way to do that is look up some affidavits. You know, you can, Winston Shrout has a lot of affidavits out there. There's some, you can read the affidavit of Walker Todd. That talks about the money system. But learn how to write an affidavit, because you're absolutely going to have to know how to write an affidavit, especially when you start learning about more private side things and becoming a national and things like that, and anything that you have to do in court. So learn how to write an affidavit, do some study on there. I could elaborate, but I don't think we have the time for that. Here's something else. If you're dealing with mortgage issues and it's inevitable that you're going to have to go to court, if you foresee yourself having to end up responding or even writing lawsuits, because even where I am, you know, sometimes I'm writing lawsuits. You guys probably heard of that program, Jurisdictionary. It's a good program. A lot of people that's dealing in courts that have to file claims or counterclaims don't understand that court is like a chess game. So I sometimes see people and they think that the judges are not paying attention to what they're doing or cheating them out of their right. In one regard, they kind of are getting cheated, but on another regard, many of the judges are playing by the rules. They just never gave you a fair shot because they know you don't know the rules and they never explained them to you. And most of the attorneys don't really even know the rules, but they don't need to, because they're already, you know, they got a special pass. But Jurisdictionary, I was going to mention, because Jurisdictionary tells you, you know, about the technicality parts of what goes on in court that you might not know about. For example, if you bring a claim, you have to make sure that each claim has all the elements necessary to support that claim. You know, like, for example, if you want it to have water, you need H2O. If you just have one part hydrogen and one part oxygen, it might look like water, but you're missing the hydrogen, so you don't have all the elements, so you don't have water. So if you're accusing somebody of fraud and you didn't allege all the elements. It's like an equation. Fraud has specific elements. It might be common sense, but common sense is not what's going on in court. Everything in court is technical. So if you're trying to go in there with common sense and your emotions about how you feel about things, you're sitting at a chessboard trying to move the pieces like checkers, and it doesn't work like that. So if you're going to be dealing with court issues, try to check out Jurisdictionary so you can learn about the technical aspects of it. And again, learn how to write affidavits in Universal Legal Technology language. That's something else that I think would be a good starting point for people to read.
Okay.
And
all right. Anything else there?
Does anybody have any specific question? Because really what I like is I love questions, because then I can see the gap that needs to be filled. Because, you know, I've been studying this stuff for so long, I know I can go way over people's head with some things. But if you ask the question, I can give it to you in a way you can understand it. So,
well, I tell you what, let's do that the next time we have a show. And I'm sure that people will want to do this again, because when they do have all of these issues and the things that they're trying to deal with, a lot of times it's like, oh my goodness, where do I go for help? Where do I go for answers? And so a part of what we do with Adventures into Sovereignty is, first of all, get people to start thinking about what it means to be a sovereign individual. You know, what's the difference between being a sovereign or being a slave? And the biggest part of that is learning to take responsibility for our own actions and finding ways. It doesn't matter what kind of things that are in front of us to deal with. It's just a matter of being willing to look at it and figure out, being able to make those decisions so that we're in charge of our affairs instead of letting somebody else deal with it by default. So a lot of that is what we do spend time studying and working with as we're working on this. And so I really appreciate what you've brought to the table tonight, and I encourage people to visit the site, especially if you're looking for things like administrative remedies and how to do some of these. You certainly can get some answers there. But let's do the Q&A part another time, Tex. I'll get
Absolutely.
Back with you and set up another time, and perhaps even we can do a webinar later on dealing with some of the administrative remedies so that people can begin to get a clear sense of how you would deal with certain specifics like that. So I would say that we've just about reached the end of our time here, and really just want to say thanks a bunch for coming on and being with us tonight, and for really engaging in this depth of conversation with us tonight.
All right. Thank you for having me.
All right. And Don, we'll let you take it out again. We just appreciate everybody being on there. And don't forget to get in touch with us, Rebecca@humanitad.org, and look for the show next week. Thank you all.